Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner. There was an article in the Sunday Sun around Police Commissioner Batts's recent comments nationally that Baltimore has a race problem. He felt he was going back in time when he came here to be police commissioner. And it ensued a great discussion, not a new discussion, but a new form of this old discussion. And then in today's paper, in today's Baltimore Sun, I should say, in today's Sun, there was an article, the lead article was, "The Mayor Calls for Ideas on Violence, Formal Address, Ways to Reduce What People Call Black-on-Black Crime." What people call was my editorial comment. And so we're going to tackle those issues, those joint issues today, with our guests. Quoted throughout the original article I spoke about is a co-host here on the Mark Steiner Show and a friend, Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. He tweets at Be More Doc. Good to have you back.
Good to be here.
I'm going to start calling you that instead. I like that. Kim Chuhart's in the studio, community activist and political leader in our community. Good to have you in the studio, Kim.
Good morning. Thank you.
Roberto Alejandro is with us, reporter for the African-American newspaper covering politics in this city in Annapolis. Good to have you here, Roberto.
Thank you for having me on.
And Michael Eugene Johnson. Michael Johnson is executive director of the Paul Robeson Institute for Social Change. Good to have you in the studio, Michael.
Good to be anywhere at this stage.
410-319-8888 is the number to call. You can email us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But do jump into this conversation. Your thoughts on this, 410-319-8888. So a lot of us who look at this particular piece that was put out because of Batts and the in the Sun around racism in Baltimore, I mean, some people I heard were taken back very immediately, going, "Is this supposed to be a news story about Baltimore or anywhere in America?" But Lawrence, let me let you lead, since you were leading this article and discussing it. I mean, what did it say to you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a powerful story in many ways, not just because I was mentioning it, but
but mainly.
But I love the fact that the context was laid, how in 1911 Baltimore passed the first racial zoning law
right. In
the country. We talk about, or the article also briefly mentions, by 1918, when Roland Park, Guilford, and Homeland Communities became a part of the city. In 1912, they had already pioneered restrictive covenants, which barred Jews and blacks from living in those particular communities. And so it laid out, I think, the foundation of what I hope we can talk about today, which is the fact that racism is not just how you feel. It's not about people's prejudices, but it's about the power of systems and institutions. And we rarely have addressed the fact that racism has real repercussions, not just in terms of the way it affects people's lives in an emotional way, but it has economic repercussions. It has political repercussions. And while we've addressed sort of the voting and political aspects of racism, we have never addressed the economic impact of racism in this country due to those policies.
And Roberto, you came in from someplace else, right?
Yeah, I grew up mostly in Massachusetts.
Right.
I was born in Puerto Rico, and I've lived sort of around the country since
college. So as somebody who didn't – both of you did not grow up in Baltimore.
Right.
So, but I'm curious your thoughts about that coming into the city, and when you hear what Batts said, what your perspective is.
I mean, I think it's one of the first things you notice when you get to Baltimore, how structurally racist it is. I mean, I always tell people, you know, Baltimore's kind of the poster child for structural racism. And even, you know, when I was speaking to my mother the other day, and she said, you know, when she first visited me the first time in Baltimore, it was the first thing she noticed. It's just how segregated. Mm-hmm. You notice that the highways all start somewhere else and end in downtown, so you can avoid all the poverty that subsidizes the wealth in the Inner Harbor and in the sort of downtown and midtown areas along the Charles Street Corridor. There's a bit of element of surprise to me in sort of the tone of like, oh, leaders are talking about people are talking about racism in Baltimore all the time. Racism in Baltimore is kind of, you know, it's probably the most common theme, and it's clearly the most prominent organizing principle that the city is under. And so, you know, I think it's hard not to notice that.
Go ahead, Kim.
Well, being born here.
Right. I'm going to talk to two native right here in a moment. Coming up now. Go ahead, Kim.
Yeah. My perspective changed once I left for almost 30 years and then came back.
You were in the service.
And, yes, right. I was in the Navy. And, coming back to Baltimore, it was offensive. It really was offensive. When I lived in other parts of the country, traveled the world, and didn't get the same kinds of pushback in those places, but I come here and doors are closed, opportunities are closed, and it is very, very, very offensive. Having, you know, tasted what could be a harmonic kind of society in other places.
Michael?
Well, being a lifelong Baltimorean and watching what was the attempted experiment of integration in Baltimore, a Northwestern senior high school being the first fully built, fully integrated, and only fully integrated high school built at that period to be integrated, and to watch within 20 years later, that school is now completely segregated. Of course, it's still segregated today. To watch neighborhoods that we knew we couldn't go in, but being like we were, we went in, having a substantial amount of friends who have other nationalities. So I did cross, you know, lines. And when I crossed lines, I was, as Kim said very eloquently, pushed back. To see an article written about something that my friend from the Afro said, we talk about every day. Not just the structure from the highways and the byways, but the health disparities and the education and the poverty and the housing and the job opportunities. And to watch when people say we're going to bring new people in the city instead of taking care of the people that are already here. Racism has already existed in a structural, institutional manner in Baltimore, and I'm glad we're having this opportunity to talk about it.
I mean, obviously the table has to be much larger to talk about this in any serious way in this city. I mean, I think that, you know, when questions are raised about is Baltimore that different? Let me stop there for a minute before I jump into where we might go. I mean, so are you all think that Baltimore is different than the rest of the country?
Well, I do think Baltimore has a particular significance. Baltimore, again, is the originator. I'd use the word apartheid in the article. Baltimore right. is the pioneer of American apartheid, urban apartheid. It developed the first racial zoning law in the country until it was put down by the Supreme Court in
1917,
Buchanan versus Worley. Then it came back with restrictive covenants, mm-hmm. which weren't struck down until 1948 in Shelley versus Kramer. And even after that, you had redlining, which again excluded black people from living in particular neighborhoods like Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland. And you have to also realize, even when we go back to racial zoning, it didn't just restrict black people from living in white neighborhoods. It also segregated churches and schools. So when you talk about how the city allocates funding to schools, of course, we had segregated schools back then. You had segregated parks. You had segregated recreational facilities. Johns Hopkins University was segregated until 1970. So segregation had real implications in terms of how the city would go about funding particular institutions and services in the city. Now, segregation is only one half of American apartheid. The other half is serial forced displacement. And that's where we talk about slum clearance in the 30s and 40s, urban renewal in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and now urban redevelopment via eminent domain in the 90s, 2000s, and 2010s. So this history in Baltimore is the pioneer of urban renewal. It sent James Rouse mm-hmm. to the Urban Renewal Development Agency in the United States. He helped pioneer a lot of those policies. So Baltimore, as Antero Patella talks about in his book, Not in My Neighborhood, really is sort of the genesis of restrictive racial policies in urban areas that were copied around this whole country. And I think that's where Baltimore is actually special. And even though we have black political leadership, even they have not dealt with the ramifications of these policies, which are still with us.
And the question is, okay, since you lead into that, and folks, I want to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. So the ramifications of those policies, so if let's get to that juncture for a moment. So what is that? So we all know and we talk about on this program a great deal over the last 22 years, and no matter what station we were in, that about structural racism and how that permeates society and permeates all the institutions of society, and it's kind of unseen but deeply felt. And unseen in some ways, but very visible in others.
Yeah.
So then, where do we go from here? What is it that this new movement? I read to you earlier when I started writing this essay this morning. When I was thinking about this, I said diversity is the mantra of the established orders. It's the word of the day. But understanding the power of racism and becoming anti-racist is the cry of the new movement. That's where we are. So the question, what does that mean in its political reality? Go ahead, Alan.
I think that the doctor brought up an important point, which is the fact that the way Baltimore looks today is a function of determined efforts, right? These were laws that were passed. These were laws that were enforced that created the context that we have today. And we're not going to undo that context without other similar means in an attempt to deconstruct the segregation and the racism that has been built into the structure and organization of the city. And I think one of the issues that Baltimore suffers from is that it has an established black political leadership class that rarely speaks the discourse of structural racism. And so we get efforts like this, you know, end black on black violence that we're seeing from the mayor, but we don't get a discussion of root causes and the policies directed at root causes. You know, nobody's opposed to mentorship initiatives, but it's not clear how that's going to really address the issues that mm-hmm. ultimately drive the problems that lead to the violence in the city. And if we're really concerned about the impact of that violence on youth, the impact of that violence on public safety and the health of the city overall, we need to look at those root structures and stop patting ourselves on the back every time we do something at the periphery.
Yeah, I think that's critically important. One of the things that we don't do is talk about the social norms that don't exist in our black communities that aren't sustainable because there's no investment in them. You know, our young men and women in this city have been not educated. The educational system has been dumbed down over the years just to sustain the workforce. That workforce, you know, we brought in folks from other countries to come in and teach. And so what we've done is created this hierarchy of learning and knowledge. And it is a black-white divide in terms of education in this city. A great example is there was a bill in Annapolis to elect a partially elected school board. And the vote in the city delegation was an 8-8 tie to move that to the full House. It really went along racial lines, mm-hmm. the vote. The vote was the white delegates in Baltimore were very comfortable with the school board and the outcomes for their children. The blacks are not. So how do we get beyond that? You know, how do we deal with the underlying issues, as Roberto said? You know, we've got to deal with uplifting our people such that they can be part of this economic society that we live in, that you have to have a degree, you have to have a job, you've got to dress a certain way. You know, we don't want to just roll over and fall completely into that system, but we need a piece of it, and we have not been allowed a piece of it.
And I think that we absolutely have to pay attention to the criminal justice system. I mean, we have to start telling the truth. I mean, that there are an abundance amount of African-American young men, teenagers and children who are going through the criminal justice system, who are not getting a fair shake or not getting the assistance they help. And if you look at the same system with other white participants in the system who are getting that extra chance. You look at just case in point of the media. Last week there was a skirmish at Morgan State University. It led the news on all four channels on all three cycles. There was also threats and internet threats from UMBC from four lacrosse girl lacrosse players that they wouldn't even tell you what it was about. Well, and when
it's
I called,
the front page of the Sun Today.
It's the front page of the Sun Today. But I'm saying, right. But when the cycle of the story came through, the cycle of the story was Morgan State University had a skirmish. There were some issues at UMBC, but they are going to suspend the girls, and that's it. So if we have to be able to say what type of message is being sent. We're not suggesting that someone's walking up to me and putting their hand up and saying, I can't come in this doorway anymore. The problem is that the doorway isn't there anymore. So we're not dealing with Jim Crow. As Al Sharpton said, we're dealing with Jim Crow Jr. now.
Well, I would call it Jim Crow Sr., but that's because I think what we're addressing now is the depth of the issue, not the walls that were put up to hide the depth and keep people separate. Now we're dealing with the real depth of the issue in American society, which is a very different place than we've ever been. Let me get to the phone show. Let's see, 410-319-8888. Mike, and this is Mike Scott. You're on the air.
Oh. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Mike. Wow.
Michael, and I had it without Matt, and it's too hard to see it. Listen, so, you know, we know what to do, Mark. It's not a question of that.
What do you mean we know what to do?
Well, we have evidence-based policies all over the country and evidence of how, you know, when we develop a common language around and intent to undo the racism that is embedded, you know, sort of racism without racism, that we can start to make some gains. But we've got to engage with the work, develop the language, and then hit the ground. And, you know, I just had breakfast with a brother that came out, one of my racial equity and healing cohort brothers from Oakland, from the African American College of Women. For the Oakland school district, and they're not talking about my brother's keeper. They're implementing. They've got data. They've got approaches. So, you know, we know what to do. The question is, do we have the political will? And I think you hit your head on it that, you know, the earlier comment about, you know, we have a political class of black elected officials that has yet to learn the language of this structural racism stuff. And in defense of the mayor, I'm quite sure that extends in a way that we're not having a conversation to the media, right? And the frame that the folks wrote that story around, you know, stepping up responsibility. We never talk about stepping up personal responsibility within the context of the system. So what is the systemic context within which we do personal responsibility? Those are solutions, journalism type conversation. That have yet another set of institutions that have biases that we've got to talk about. But I would posit that we know exactly what we need to do
Mike, you're breaking up a little bit, and you got my email this morning in response to your email to me and to Lawrence earlier today. And our commitment to make sure that you and Equity Matters are on this program in the very next conversation we have, which will be within days, not weeks. And so, because I really do want to explore, we have to take a quick break here, but I do want to explore what Michael was saying when he says we know what to do. I want to know what that means. What do you mean we know what to do? What is that? That's what I want to understand. What it means to know what we do. And so Michael can talk about evidence-based practices, which I want to hear about, but I want to know what it means. What do we do? So 410-319-8888. We are going to break here, with the great Sarah Vaughan. Whatever Lola Wants, recorded on this day in 1955. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Back to the phones.
Wants you. Make up your mind to have.
Make up your mind to have.
No regrets.
No regrets.
Recline yourself.
What you are.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And that, of course, is Nat King Cole. That's unforgettable. Nat King Cole was born on this day in 1919. The great Nat King Cole. And we are talking here with Dr. Lawrence Brown, Kim Schuhart, Michael Eugene Johnson, and Roberto Alejandro about the question of race and racism in Baltimore raised by Commissioner Batts. And the issues were raised in today's paper that the mayor raised in her State of the City address on what people call black-on-black crime. And I'm going to go right to the phones here to get your thoughts. And really, we do want to explore, what does it mean we know what to do? What does that mean? You were saying what, Kim, at break?
I said that there are plenty of black men in this city who have stepped up. And I think there's an opportunity to expand their reach. And I don't see that this initiative is going to help them continue to do the great work that they're doing. I think there needs to be some funding put behind it. I think the capacity to do the great things that are being done in small pockets has to be elevated and enhanced.
Roberto, then I'm going to go right to the phones.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues I have is that we often pursue solutions that don't seem to address the problem. So take this sort of mentorship initiative, which certainly I'm not opposed to in principle. But let's say we get a bunch of really good job training coaches in front of these teenage boys and really help them to learn how to master the art of doing a job interview. Will that change the fact that a black man with a college degree is less likely to get a callback than a white person with a felony conviction when applying for jobs? No. And so it's not that these efforts are misguided or bad, but that ultimately they're trying to address a problem by not addressing the root issues. And they then, I think, compound the problem by engaging in a discourse, this discourse of black-on-black crime or black-on-black violence, which seems to suggest that it's some problem of blackness that drives the violence. When one, violence is just an American problem. We love violence in America. Mm-hmm. And two, the violence is a result of something. It's not like black people are running around going, oh, we love violence. We can't wait to do more violence. The violence is a symptom of the crushing poverty and desperation that is occurring in many of the communities in Baltimore City. Yes. And so it's tough to get behind some of these programs where they're accompanied by this discourse of sort of black shaming with phrases like this.
Right, Cookie Lawrence, I might hit the phones here.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, Michael raised a great point about, you know, what do we do? I mean, we have to think about the responsibility of leaders of systems, right? And so what you have with both Batts and Rawlings Blake is a sort of seemingly progressive discourse where they're talking about racism, but they're not talking about their responsibility of the systems that they are leaders of. And so when you're talking, and she mentioned, well, you know, I go out and people look at me when I'm with a mixed company. Well, that's maybe prejudice, but we're talking about racism. Mm-hmm. We're talking about what are you going to do about these TIFs and pilots that you're giving to harbor billionaires like Michael Beatty, but you're not investing heavily in Upton, Druid Heights, Greenmount East, and other communities that are disinvested. That's what we're talking about, not yep. prejudice. We're talking about racism, systems. Mm-hmm. And for Batts, you talking about 1950s racism. No, let's talk about the police department. Let's talk about almost $6 million of cases that people have filed and settled with the city in terms of police brutality. Luke Broadwater from the Baltimore Sun said that in the past 8 years, police have killed 54 people. Let's talk about implicit racial bias in policing. Let's talk about anti-black policing in black neighborhoods, because over 70% of our officers don't live in Baltimore. So when they come into the city, they're coming to a black neighborhood that they often disdain, and they don't really have the best interests of those people in heart. They don't believe, as Alejandro said earlier, that people actually are there to do good. They believe everybody's there as a drug dealer, everybody's on welfare. So they come in with a very negative context. So what is he going to do about that? That's what I want to know. Like, don't talk about racism in a very general and broad way. That's cute, but we need you to talk about the systems that you run. Do something about that.
So, and I'm curious. I'm going to hit the phones here, but I'm going to come back. And taking off from what you just said and what you all just said, I'm going to play off what Michael Scott just said. I just sent an email inviting him on the next couple of days to continue this conversation. To talk about, we know what to do. What does that? I still want to know, what does that mean? We know what to do. 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones here. A lot of people calling in. Let's go to a new name. I think it's a new name. I don't know. So many names are the same. Nick, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well, Nick.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Hello.
We can hear you.
You're on the air, Nick. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my comment had to specifically deal with the education system. And, you know, as a person that actually was a former educator, there is those tiers in the system, but in terms of the hiring practices, why they had to go outside and get those people, I think it's important to recognize who's actually applying and qualified and skilled to get those jobs. And some of that actually, some of those people are very qualified. They just don't end up making it for a variety of reasons. But, you know, it's very difficult with respect to connecting, regardless of race, with respect to that.
You're talking about, I'm not quite sure I get what you were saying. Are you trying to say that people who are qualified and to become teachers, I don't understand the discussion. I'm not quite clear. Could you just tighten that up with one sentence, what you're trying to say?
Sorry. Pretty much, I remember there was a comment about having to import people from other countries to teach. And I think it's unfair to act like it causes a peer structure because it feel like you're saying, oh, we have to import these people and they'll be... I feel like it was implied that these people would be inferior.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I got you. Okay, thanks. Now I understand completely what you're saying. You're talking, and I think Kim Chuhar was talking about saying that, and I think that was when the uproar happened because the people of from the Philippines were brought over to teach in Baltimore City schools, and there was an uproar around that. That's what you were referring to.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that let me go back to the phone and we'll come right back to the panel. 410-319-8888. Jamal, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, so I'd like to piggyback to one of the commentators earlier that mentioned about the leaving of the city and returning and seeing how offensive it was. I can agree. I am a living and working artist in the city and have lived in multiple cities and can attest that it is very offensive to come back and return and see the conditions of how the African American or black population is being treated in the city. And understanding the history and context of what was mentioned earlier with the stated facts, as well as family members telling me the historical analysis of developing from the African American diaspora, the east side to the west side, and boundaries being crossed and breaking barriers to integrating schools and things of that sort. One of the things I like to talk about or maybe suggest perhaps is resolution, because this is a constant conversation discussed all the time in the circles, artistry, and as well as now with the whole gentrification process and things the way Baltimore stands right now. And I would say that instead of attacking or constantly dealing with the whole racial construct, one of the things would be to rebuild the black community with those who are working, such as someone mentioned earlier, with a little bit we have, and taking those resources, rebuilding the community, and work around the chaos and other things that's going on right there, such as rebuilding the Harlem of Baltimore, which would be Pennsylvania Avenue. And my question would be not to sit and relax and wait for someone to give you a handout, but what are those that are in the mayoral candidate or in the top-ranking offices of the money, how are they alleviating these funds, and are they make an attempt to reach out and rebuild the community rather than investing in the harbor and downtowns of those sorts to rebuild for only the concept of getting money and not concerned with rebuilding the black community, being that this is a 95% black city?
It's actually 63%. Let's talk about it. We've talked about that a lot. This is before we go back to the phones here and go to Matt and Hank and Merrick and other callers waiting in. The question of we know what to do. Let's pick up what's just said here, and what that really means, and how you make this how you do a different kind of investment.
Yeah, well, Mark, look at Howard Park and the supermarket there. We were a food desert for 15 years since the last supermarket closed. Okay, that took the community, city government, and outside investors coming together to do a very different development, okay? A very different than the downtown Harbor Point TIF kind of development, okay? It even consisted of us going to Washington and getting an $800,000 grant, right, to help offset some of the supermarket's expenses in terms of what we as a community wanted. So there are opportunities for us to partner and engage in development in neighborhoods that are not the traditional approaches. And so until we want earnestly and have the will to sit down, and that was hard. Don't get me wrong. It was a hard pull. Right now, we're not doing that across the city, and we need to.
And what it's just a quick aside, right? You're talking about the corner of El Dorado and Liberty Heights?
Yes.
And
well,
Hillsdale.
It's Hillsdale.
Hillsdale. Yes. Hillsdale, Liberty Heights. And now, what is the supermarket there now?
It's ShopRite.
That's what I thought. Okay. Just checking. I'll just get it so I have my head right. So,
well, I think that also, I think that Kim says all of the time, and it's about the will. I mean, if you have the will to say you're not going to have an all-white fire department class, that's the will to integrate the fire department. If you say you're going to have the will that the percentage of police officers that are going into the recruitment are going to come. We had a fire and police high school academy that was supposed to drive and direct young people to get into those particular professions. It wasn't supported by the police department and it wasn't supported by the fire department. It was supported by North Avenue. So, of course, when North Avenue had to do its changes and its cuts, that's what cut. If we don't have the will to say that black folk in Baltimore City are not getting an opportunity, just all we want is an opportunity, because we can do.
That's right.
Get an opportunity, then we don't have the will to say that there's a problem. And so suddenly, this is sexy. This is sexy to talk about, is there racism in Baltimore? But the point being is, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, there was an all-white fire class, fire department class that was put into Baltimore City. And so we sit and we talk about the schools, when structurally, our schools are structural that you either have what they call the five, and Dr. Banks used to always say, and then you got the rest. And the rest are struggling on different levels. I understand what the mayor is going to do about approaching it, but I do appreciate the fact when we're saying that black-on-black crime is some sort of disease. But when the actuality is that before you put $16 million into a race car contest downtown, if you put $16 million around Pennsylvania Avenue, North Avenue, and East Baltimore, and in closing, because I know you got callers, in closing,
yeah.
We cannot sit here and say that we don't have educated people. We got five of the top universities in America that are sitting within our borders, especially Morgan State University. So when you got Morgan and John Hopkins and Maryland and St. Mary's and all of these schools around, and we say we have to go across the water to bring people in, or that our young people don't have a free opportunity or an opportunity to go to these institutions, then racism in Baltimore exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know it exists. I mean, I think anybody, and I agree. I mean, that's one of the things we just got. It's here. But Roberto, and then let me go over here and go back to the phones, because we really got to
get. Yeah, I think the will is certainly an important issue, but it's also going to take some creativity. I mean, I know Sherrilyn Ifill recently spoke at the University of Maryland School of Law and talked about the need for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund to redouble their efforts on challenging segregation in the courts. But of course, challenging racial issues in American courts has been made really difficult by the mm-hmm. Supreme
yep.
Court,
mm-hmm.
which has also made ruled unconstitutional a number of initiatives like affirmative action and things of this nature, racial quotas, that would directly address mm-hmm. the history of laws designed to deprive mm-hmm. black people of resources in this country. And so we need a leadership that's not only willing to pursue policies, but also who's willing to act creatively. You know, I always wonder why the police department doesn't just buy up a couple of vacants, fix them up, take two officers, move them in, and say, you're patrolling this neighborhood, and now you're living in it. Because they could give that house to the officer without any tax implications for the officer, because they just say it's for the benefit of the employer, and then it's not counted as income on that person's mm-hmm. Taxes.
Right, and those are the kind of creative solutions that have to happen, just like the man who called the show the other day and last week and said, I'm an electrician. There are hundreds of men like me in Baltimore who are skilled, ready to work, and instead of investing in just private developers, why don't help these men start a co-op to mm-hmm. take over some of these houses, rebuild them, and mm-hmm. put families in them?
But you also
there are a lot of creative ways.
Mm-hmm. But you also have you also have Merville, Carver, and Westside Skills Center, mm-hmm. where we're putting lecturers and HVCs and all of these students that we're pushing through these schools, and they know this stuff, but they can't even get a job when they leave mm-hmm. the high school. But
right.
they know the stuff.
Well, at least they know, they're getting ready to know this stuff.
Well, you know, I mean, certification that's another story.
That's why they go to community colleges to get the final 2 years of their
right.
certification.
But I often find that people are in a rush to move to solutions without adequately understanding the problem. Mm. It's like if you're a medical doctor and you're trying to deal with cancer, you just can't go in and do anything and say, well, we got to hurry up and deal with it. No, you have to understand mm-hmm. the science of how cancer operates and kills people. Racism is a cancer, And we have to learn how it works and how it operates. Because in addition to the legacy issues that I talked about, we got to talk about reverse redlining, the subprime lending that targeted Black and Latino communities in this country. We have to talk about gentrification, which is also the displacement of poor families. We have to talk about the dismantling of public housing, which is taking place, the towers that were torn down, people sent out into the county, and then also the fact that the public housing is being privatized right now with HUD's RAD program, the Rental Assistance Demonstration. We have to talk about schools, massive school closures that are happening in Black communities. New Orleans, the first one to private charterize its whole school district. Baltimore is on its way with that, especially with the Republican governor. We're talking about the privatization of public education, the privatization of our prison systems. We're not understanding how this cancer of racism really operates even today. And of course, the legacy of racism, the legacy of the old Jim Crow was that those segregation policies, they allowed white families to build wealth, especially in their homes, that Black families were not able to build. So when we talk about poverty, we have to think about wealth and the wealth that Black people have not been able to build as a whole, because land has both been confiscated and because really we have to think about the fact that colonization of land. Land is really what's at the root of racism. It's about territory, control of places where people live and the resources that people have. And so once we understand all that, then we could talk about solutions, because then we would have to talk about reparations. Mm. We would have to talk about land restitution. We would have to talk about making sure people have health care that they don't have to pay for because of these health disparities that are enacted and implemented, are basically embodied because of these policies and laws that are both historical and contemporary.
Can we start with the government institutions that are broken? You know, we have a police department that potentially could be the one that we want, that protects and serves us, but they've got to make some significant internal changes. We have a school system that has a school board that doesn't oversee what the CEO does. Why don't they scrutinize all of the policies? Why don't they look at the concepts and the proposals and validate the outcomes for our children? And so until we get the institutions that we supposedly already control through our electoral process, until we get those institutions under control, we can't expect the white enterprise to look at us and say, y'all can't even, like, get your own act in order.
Yeah, but I think in some ways that sets up a false dichotomy, because it makes this, you know, it's because that's exactly what happened under William Donald Schaefer. He said, so you folks want power? School system's yours. And that set up the road to disaster because it became underfunded, and that's, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's, the schools are not a Black institution. The schools are a public institution.
Exactly. And we are the public, right? And we, as voting public, we have, like, let our children down. We don't participate in this government sufficiently to ensure the outcomes that we expect. We say it's somebody else's job to do that. No, it is our job. And this personal accountability thing is critically important to this conversation, because if we don't individually step up and be the representative of the government that we want, okay, we've got to do that. Can't anybody do that for us? And I wasn't here when the Schaefer school system disaster happened, but I'm here now.
That was just the beginning of the disaster.
I'm here now.
But let me open the phone. I have to hit the phone. So 410-319-8888. People have been holding on for a long, long time here. So, Matt, you're on the air. Matt, you still with us?
I'm here. Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah. How's everybody doing?
Very well.
Good. How are you?
Good, good. I'm fine. I just wanted to speak on, you know, when we talk about racism, you know, sometimes we overlook what's right in front of our nose when a traditionally Black college, which is Morgan State, can't even have, you know, Black representation, you know, on morning shows. You know, you got an Amy Goodman coming on, you know, the white liberals, and then you got this show, white liberals. It's like, where's the strong Black voices that used to be on Morgan?
Well, they're still here. Let me just interrupt for a second. A, they're still here. They're all over the station. I'm the only person who has one of the only people on the station who is not African American with the show. So there are tons of strong voices in this show. And B, I take umbrage. I'm not a liberal. I've never called myself a liberal. I will never be a liberal. That's not my politics. But I think that that is the thing for me here is that this is an African-American-led station owned and controlled by the black people of this community. And just like in Reconstruction, when we had black-led governments, it was the only place where all of the people could come in equally to work together, which is what this station is. And I think that's the difference here.
Right. And if there is an issue with Morgan State, it's that it's not funded on par with the University of Maryland.
That is a problem.
We're talking about segregation in higher education, and there's a lawsuit out now. We've got to address that.
Right. I mean, there's the inequities in funding.
Duplication.
Yep, program duplication.
Exactly. How business schools are created that took away from Morgan's business school mm-hmm. without making kind of the other arrangements. And all those are the key issues here.
And really, to keep from integrating how they built the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, you know, didn't fund Morgan State. So mm-hmm. these are the types of things. That's racism. Policies, systems, right. practices. Mm. We still haven't addressed it.
And that's what we have to address. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Rick. You're on the air. Hi, Rick. You with us? Rick?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning, panel.
Good morning. Morning.
Mark, I've called you before. I'm from the Eastern Shore. That statement the gentleman just made about the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, I attended that school. I'm the proud father of two Morgan State graduates that
right
both
now.
Have their master's degrees. Now, hopefully the guy, Scott, who called in said, we know what the answer is. Well, I hope he's hitting on what I think the answer is, and that is economics. Until we control our economics as black people, we will never have control of our destiny. What I mean by that is, right now, you have the Walton family, the people that own Walmart, that have 98% of all the black money in our community. That is incredible to even wrap your head around. We have to go back to doing things like supporting our neighborhood banks, supporting our churches, and supporting our school. Those are three pillars that start any community. And if you don't have those three strong things in any community, you don't have communities. As far as our police department, yes, as long as you got 70% of other people coming into this neighborhood and taking those dollars that they get their paychecks with back out to other neighborhoods, you still dissolving your own infrastructure. We need more police officers from within the city, living within the city. You guys have politicians who have the intestinal fortitude to see these things and say, hey, we have to stop this stuff. I don't care if it's the fire department. I don't care if it's the police department. I don't care if it's the longshoremen. All of these people I have seen. I came to Baltimore in 1980. I came up here to work for a defense contractor. Professionally, I'm an electronic technician. The company I worked for at that time had 362 technicians, and only two were black. When we got hired, the first thing one of the supervisors said was, there goes the neighborhood. Mm-hmm.
Brother, you done said it all.
Really? I think that, Rick, hold on a second. Maybe we should get you on as a guest. I'll get my producer to pick up and get your number to have you come and join us for these people's conversations here on the air. Because I think that this, the heart of the matter is what we're getting to it, and that's what I'm talking about, solutions to what we face. Because part of it is there's an election coming up in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a point where people can – this is one tier. There are many tiers. Mm-hmm. But is mobilizing to put – young, maybe not so young, some of them, but young, new, creative, unfrightened people in the city council that can actually push and have voices heard and not just be business as usual. There are a lot of young people right now running, black and white in this city, who are running to make that change in this next council. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are the things that begin to chip away at this madness. Mm-hmm. We have like maybe 5 minutes left, but go ahead, Kim. I'm going to get around the room here.
Okay, on Friday, February the 13th, I invited the current Police Academy class to come to my rec center. That class was 43 cadets. They came for 3 hours. We, as a community, spoke with them. They spoke with the principal, some of the staff. We took them into the classrooms. And these are young folks in the academy without their guns coming into an African-American community.
In Howard Park on Liberty Heights?
Yes. Uh-huh. And it was a wonderful 3-hour session with them. And we dialogued and had a great conversation about guns in schools, about body cameras, just engaging with them. Now, mind you, only of the 43, about 10 were African Americans.
Mm. Wow.
Okay? So that's the current class, class 1501. Okay?
We're almost out of time.
And so there is an opportunity here that we need to take on. You talk about how do we go forward. You know, we need to engage with these people.
And also, 10? Lord have mercy.
You know, those stories, the one that Ms. Trueheart just gave, the caller gave before, two out of the 40 or 60-something being black, those are the types of issues that, if we're talking about this new political leadership, 2016 being a new opportunity, we need people that will pass and propagate anti-racist policies, specifically race-conscious policies that are designed to undo racism in this country. If we're not doing that, we ain't doing nothing.
So I want to do want to announce something here. Some callers have suggested this at this moment. I have one on my screen. I see Owen is called in saying, extend this program for another hour. Well, we can't legally extend it for another hour because we have an obligation with a funder for next hour's show, so we have to put that on, or there would be no Mark Steiner show, and I don't want to walk away just yet. Even though some folks would like to see me go on, I'm not going anywhere just yet. So
today is not the retirement announcement.
Today is not the retirement announcement, no. But I do want to say, as my producer Mark just put it here, yes, I do want to do that. I want to announce that we're going to continue this conversation tomorrow. Invite some of these guests who were here today back on. Invite Michael Scott back on and others to continue this in some depth. And because I think it's a really critical, important subject, so that Hank and Owen and Rick and Malik can get on the air. And I'm sorry, Bruce, you didn't get on the air, but you've been on three times already this week. And so we finally give some other people a chance. But it's an important discussion to have. And I want to thank the folks here, Morgan's Lawrence Brown and the Afro-Americans, Roberto Alejandro, and two of Baltimore's leading activists, Kim Trueheart and Michael Eugene Johnson, for being in the studio. Thank you four so much for being here.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
As we go to break, we're going to be hearing John Sebastian of The Love and Spoonful, because Summer in the City, he was born on this day in 1944. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From funding to testing, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That is MarylandEducators.org. We'll be right back with Sound Bites.
Meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop.